Okay, we left off after receiving.
Yeah. Well, the TFT was
what was it like before 1980?
We had number of small locals. There were Houston and Corpus that each had more than 1,000 members or more. This is in 1980. Houston, Corpus Christi was the biggest at that time. El Paso had about 500 members. And Laredo had about 500 members. Dallas, because of some political things that went on prior, it's a long story, Harley Hiscox and his saga, he had been banished to Dallas, and the deal was that he was given a very small grant to organize Dallas with the understanding he would not pay dues to the State Federation. In part so that they could use that money to organize, but also in part because the national organizing director wanted Harley out of the state political scene. Harley had just led a coup to get rid of the president of TFT, even though he was working as her assistant at the time he started it. And the guy that won turned out to be a real inadequate president.
That was Wilcox?
Yes. Anyway, we had locals with 20 members. They could not represent their members in any meaningful way. They didn't have enough mass to be able to put together the resources to even put out newsletters or do basic things. Frequently, they were people who'd organized into a group for reasons that were not in keeping with AFT's goal and mission. There were several that asked for and received charter. El Paso in those days was one. But there were many others over in the Beaumont, what's called the Golden Triangle in Texas, the Beaumont-Port Arthur area, that were organized because they viewed the NEA as too liberal. And by this time, the NEA had unified with the TSDA, and these were dissident groups within the TSDA. Well, not dissident within the TSDA. They were dissident at being forced to join the NEA, which they viewed as a liberal organization. And so they formed an AFT local. Then you had groups that were formed under the illusion that if you called yourself a union, that of itself conferred upon you some power, prestige, or influence you would not ordinarily have. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in San Antonio, where there are a number of school districts, We have the Northeast Federation of Teachers, the North Side Federation of Teachers, East Central Federation of Teachers, South Side Federation of Teachers, South San Antonio Federation of Teachers, Harlandale Federation of Teachers, Edgewood Federation of Teachers, and the San Antonio Federation of Teachers. Collectively, they might have had 300 members. We had a local in Odessa that should never have received a charter, made up entirely of bus drivers. No capacity to pay enough dues to 39 of them or something. We had a local in Port Arthur. Got to be, and we had had a teacher local there, and then they got diverted onto what always seems to be an easy, attractive path of recruiting classified employees who will join more readily than teachers usually. But once the word got out that the classified employees dominated and they elected a classified employee as president, the teachers began to drop, and soon you had another classified-only organization. They were unable to support any activity. And meanwhile, the State Federation had a president, two organizers, two secretaries, three organizers, six people, most of which was financed by an AFT grant. Mm-hmm. Let me rethink that. Dick Arnold, Deborah Brickens, Len Migarelli, three organizers, the president, two secretaries. There was no newsletter from the State Federation. There was no legislative program. Each year there would be some bill that usually won the mandate duty-free lunch that was associated with us, and that would be the legislative program. Since there was no lobbyist, our presence in the Capitol was not even up to the smoke and mirrors level. When we campaigned in Corpus Christi, we said over and over again, yeah, but you don't live in Austin. It was a liability. The TFT was a liability to organizing efforts. So all of this was known. Meanwhile, in Corpus Christi, I had just married and was blissfully happy. We'd won the election, accomplished everything I'd set out to do, and I had begun making arrangements to return to teaching, which, thanks to the work we'd done politically, I was able to line up. Superintendent wouldn't have liked it, but he didn't have the votes to keep me away anymore. In fact, he didn't have the votes on the board that I did at that time, so...
Can we back up just a second? How is it that Corpus was able to get a pseudo collective bargaining agreement where the rest of Texas couldn't?
We didn't get a collective bargaining agreement. We did get a contract with the district. And there are two answers to your question. One is legalistic, and one is in terms of practical historical accomplishments, I guess. Legally, what we did is we lumped together all the board policies that dealt with employee matters. And then we had the school board sign an agreement saying they would not change any of those policies for a period of 2 years, except through consultation with the Corpus Christi AFT.
Okay.
Those, and then it was a, there was a catch-all that says, nor any change in salaries, working conditions, or wages, to keep them from adding a whole new section.
Mm-hmm.
But it said, board policies 4100 through 4999 will not be changed from the period 1979 through 1981, except through consultation with the Corpus Christi AFT. Then we had a procedure where both mutual agreement, we could change things, and in emergencies we had a clause where either the administration or the union could take something from the school board if we couldn't agree and felt there was a need to change a policy, and then the board could decide what they wanted to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the legalistic answer. The case was never tested in court. Our argument would have been that it wasn't collective bargaining and that school boards have the right to hire consultants. They have the right to give consultants contracts, including the exclusive right to be the only consultant on a given thing. They have efficiency, air conditioning experts. They hire consultants to consult with them on their health insurance or their liability insurance. So we were the consultant on employee-related matters. And I think that argument would prevail. And I think their attorney thought it would prevail because after I left, when Linda first took over, a new superintendent came in, we having gotten rid of the old one, and he tried to get him to repeal that policy, and the attorney told him, you can't change it till 1981. So, now in terms of practical effect, it was a combination of people who understood what the mission was, who were in it for the right reasons, and who were willing to work incredibly hard to make it happen. Examples. Linda Bridges' mother had a stroke, went into the hospital, and died eventually. But during the period while she was there, she came by the union office, picked up a box of newsletters that we prepared, took them to the waiting rooms to fold to keep herself occupied, and then people there started saying, I'm bored, give me some of those. Now, I worked every day, including Christmas, for a little bit, for the period from 1975 through 1981 when I left on the union. Now, on Christmas Day, it wasn't a lot, maybe. Fold a few flowers while I was watching a football game, something, but every day we worked. We went. You know, we did things other people would not want to do, did not want to do. We got in our cars in the summer in Corpus Christi and drove from house to house, not just me. We had teams, four teams, five teams out sometimes a night. We were focused on we had a plan, and we had a calendar, and that plan was followed. You know, you can't always follow your calendar slavishly, but by and large, we didn't let ourselves say, gee, well, let's just blow this off.
Right.
And and the benefit of a lot of people breaking ground before us, the whole idea of how to get the agreement came from, I think, Albuquerque, which in those days there was no collective bargaining law. You know, I told you I rode around asking for contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here comes this one, and it's not a contract. It says board policy this and this can't be changed. And it's like, bing, flashlight goes off. I didn't think of this myself. Somebody else thought of it, but... and I did formula time. In those days, they made you do 20 days a year. And I, in Cincinnati, unfortunately, in a way, impressed Mercedes Hill, who was a national rep, and she asked for me everywhere she went thereafter. I wound up in Florida, in Brevard, when we won that election. I wound up in Baltimore when we won that one. Won Loretta's, not for Loretta to get the Paris, but for the teachers.
Right.
All that was, and Linda went to Atlanta, at least. I can't remember all of Albuquerque, I think. And we were constantly asking people, talking to people, picking up ideas and learning. But we had a group of people who were just committing to the right things. We didn't form the union. I'm sure there were some people who joined the union because they considered our superintendent to be a jerk. And personally, I liked the guy, even though he was the embodiment of everything that education did wrong and set us up for the disaster we're now facing. Mm-hmm. The policies he put in place were like a litany of the catastrophic policies that led to the virtual almost destruction of public education in this country. He was a nice guy, though, pleasant, charming. And since then, trying to explain this to groups that I go out and talk to over the years, I would hear them say, you know, the superintendent's a jerk, we got to get rid of this guy. And I would say, your problem isn't that your superintendent's a jerk. He may be, I don't know. Your problem is that you have a system where the superintendent has such influence over your lives and the lives of these students. And I would say, looking back on history, King George III was a reasonably pleasant, unobjectionable king. It wasn't George III that was the problem. It was the fact that Americans decided they would no longer live under monarchy. And that's what you have to, you know, that's what you have to understand about the union movement. It isn't the superintendent that's the problem. It's the system that's the problem. So I was blessed with people that got that picture pretty early on. And we preached that message over and over again. You know, that people would... And by the way, one of the things that I've observed around in 24 years in Texas, one of the quickest ways to destroy a union is they pick up on the fact that if you win a school board election, you can get the superintendent fired. Then, after that's done, they say, well, that problem's taken care of. Then you look out and there's no union left. Then in a few years later, you get a phone call saying, what do we have to do to get the union started here? We just have a union around here. Mm-hmm. So we had that. There was also, you know, a confluence of forces. Hispanic activism was on the rise in South Texas. We capitalized on that tremendously. At a time when the majority of teachers were Anglos, we looked at the student population, though, and we looked at the population, and we said the future in this city is with people who have brown skin, mm-hmm. and those people were looking for a piece of the action. At the same time we were able to put together coalitions. That was significant. A lot of our groups never get that picture. Teachers cannot do this thing by themselves. That's where organized labor should be so important and can be so important. That's why it's such a catastrophe for all of us that labor is falling apart in this moment.
Because we're losing a lot of our voice.
We're losing our base.
Yeah.
The teachers are a tiny, tiny percentage of any community. The parents, the taxpayers, those people used to be the working people that belonged to the unions. Mm-hmm. They supported the public schools. And now that, I mean, who would have ever thought that we would see an attack on the institution of public education on the scale that we've seen in this country? Well, it would not have happened if we maintained a strong, vigorous labor movement in this country. In those days, Corpus Christi, by Texas standards, had one of the stronger, more vigorous labor movements. There were about 10,000 union members in the Coastal Bend Labor Council. Mm-hmm. The largest union was the steel workers. Today, there's not a steel worker member left. There are no steel plants left.
Wow.
OCAW was a big one, Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers. I don't know that there are any OCAW members down there anymore. There are damn few in Texas. Mm-hmm. Used to be one of the biggest unions in the state. Business, to a certain extent, labor's decline isn't its own fault. Steelworkers did nothing to bring on the catastrophe of the 80s, nor did the oil workers. But nevertheless, the unions that are left are disproportionately service area workers and public workers, which doesn't bode well for the future of the labor movement. Two biggest unions in Texas now are CWA and AFT.
CWA, what is CWA?
Communication workers.
Yeah, well,
telephone.
They have the telephone on here?
Sprint, Bell, Bell South.
Oh, that's right, Bell South.
Some public workers, although they spent a huge amount of money to get precious little.
Yeah. And SEIU is trying to move into Houston?
So they say. It's hard to know what SEIU really is doing. SEIU in Texas has been its worst incarnation because the local that the SEIU gave jurisdiction is Local 100, which began life as an ACORN group, not a labor group, and chose to try to get their members by raiding other labor unions, including us. And when you say trying to organize in Houston, what they're trying to do is raid AFSCME.
Yeah, well, that's going on across the country.
And AFSCME was in trouble there anyway.
Oh, we got a little off track.
I was just looking up. In 2002, the last time I checked, SEIU had 1,569 members in Texas. Anyway, I was in Corpus Christi preparing to leave my union career behind and become a teacher again when I received an unusual visit from Richard Shaw, who was then president of the Houston Federation of Teachers, and Harley Hiscox, who was the president of the Dallas Federation of Teachers, and who hated one another with cold, unblinding fury. And they both came to Corpus Christi to ask me to move aside the person that was president of the TFT and become the president. So I knew the state federation was in bad shape, but this was clearly a sign that things were terrible. Although neither Richard nor Harley had any idea how bad. After discussing it, we managed a coup. With AFT's assistance, they were crucial because they had to provide him with a golden parachute, which was a
full-time position as president of the Austin Federation of Teachers. Mm-hmm. And in January 1981, he stepped down and I was appointed president by the Executive Council. Within 2 weeks, I discovered that although publicly we were claiming 15,000 members, we had about 3,500 paying per capita. That didn't surprise me so much. I also discovered the bookkeeper had been embezzling on a big scale, such that only about $1 out of every 10 collected made it into the TFT's accounts. The next 3 or 4 months were, well, the next year was awful. Obviously, I fired the bookkeeper, and funny, prior to my taking over as president, some months prior, there had been a fire at the TFT office. It turned out that she had set that fire because she thought someone was on her trail and might catch her, and she wanted to cover her tracks. So she had burned all the records, including, and all the machinery, and so the TFT had a two-room office on top of a mail strip joint in downtown Austin. And that was about it. It had this desk, same desk, and telephone, I guess a receptionist desk. But we acquired some nice furniture because I got a call from this penthouse manager who said we were behind in payments on our penthouse. And I said, we don't have a penthouse. And he said, sure you do. Texas Federation of Teachers, contact person, Jolie Chandler. She was the bookkeeper. And so I said, well, I'm sorry to, this is bad news for you, but you're not going to get any future payments. And he said, well, what are you going to do with all your furniture? I said, we're going to come get it. So I... For a while, my office had this couch that looked like it came out of a New Orleans cat house, white with silver bangles flecked all through it, fluffy, and a matching chair. National Treasurer, Secretary Treasurer of AFT had noticed that my predecessor had let the fire insurance lapse. And so when the fire occurred, we had no insurance. But my Secretary Treasurer noticed that we had let also the bond lapse. And in those days, AFT officials were required to be bonded for $5,000. So he had, on his own initiative, had AFT pay, this was back before I was president, to get us covered. This was important because the check for $5,000 came, and I'm sitting at my desk opening my mail, and this guy, two guys come in and flash badges and say, we're with the IRS. You owe us $17,000 and counting. And what had happened is, of course, the bookkeeper had collected the money from FICA but had not passed it on. So I said, well, would $5,000 as a starting point satisfy you for right now? And they said, yes. So I flipped that check over, signed it, and handed it to them. Said, there you go. Later, the fees and interest were much more than the original amount that we owed. And one of the first things I did, and it was a tough political fight, was I got Sharon hired to be the bookkeeper for TFT. I had to have somebody I could trust and rely upon. And she went to the IRS, and when they started describing all that we owed, she started crying. And before she got out of there, they agreed to settle for just the back deposits. My predecessor also had bought a fleet of cars.
Oh, jeez.
And had gotten written into the staff contract, since he discovered that if the staff got it, he would get it. That they were guaranteed a car, and they got holidays. Any holiday that was an Austin Independent School District holiday, any state holiday, and any national holiday. So the first time I met with the staff union, I said, let's list the days you want to work. It'll be a shorter list. And we had to go through this horrible thing. We literally could not meet contractual obligations. Right. So we had to say, look, I'm sorry, we either start laying people off or we take things away. So we went, all of us went without retirement. We kept the retirement plan in place and people could pay into it, but the union contributed nothing. And we, same thing with health insurance. We kept the health insurance plan, but people had to pay their own costs. Mm-hmm. We cut everybody's salary significantly. Took away the cars. Sharon sold them to through the want ads. They had a contract clause that said that they got the car and we paid car insurance, and they had a credit card and they could charge gasoline even if it was just driving around town. So we had a really horrible first year dealing with that. Then there were the political problems. Dallas wasn't paying any per capita, so now one of the things I did do, since I was in a pretty strong position with vis-a-vis AFT, they wanted that guy out and wanted me to take the job, as I insisted that we would hire a lobbyist. And this was very difficult for Phil Kugler to accept, because Phil's belief was that any assistance money went into recruitment activities only. But since I was in a pretty strong position, I said, well, this is how it is, that either this way or I don't take the job. And I hired the, not my immediate predecessor, but June Karp, who had been president before him, who'd been, politically, she'd been pretty hostile. She and I had been at each other's throats, but she was well-liked in Dallas. Not in Dallas. Dallas hated her. She was well-liked in Houston. And also she needed a job. Mm-hmm. But we needed, and she was known in Austin. She was well-known in the Capitol. And she became our first lobbyist. So, because among other things, if you're going to recruit members, it's truly said that hope makes an adequate breakfast but a very bad supper. You have to be able at the end of the day to show something. And then I sat down. I was in January 81, that was the legislative year. So one of the first things I did was sit down with the education code and write a school finance bill. Never had done that before, but I just read the school finance provisions, figured out how the formulas worked, and I wrote one that, frankly, had they passed, would have put them years ahead of where they wound up on equalization of funding, because the school finance was just a catastrophe in those days. Literally, the state gave more money to wealthy districts than it did to poor districts, because of the way they had worded the formulas. It was a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I wrote one, and then I got a guy, Corpus Christi legislator, to introduced it so that we would have a legislative program that featured a significant pay raise, more money for needy students who disproportionately reside in Hispanic and Black areas, helping us build our coalition there. And built a advocacy campaign around let's pass this bill, which it did not. Never made it out of committee. We may have had a good committee hearing.
I bet.
Then...
but you made your presence on...
Right. We began to make it known that the Texas Federation of Teachers was going to be an organization of substance in the Capitol. And then I started, we started an organizing program where I and some other people identified initially six things that a local had to do to survive in Texas. And we called this the six-point program. And I told the organizers, this is what you are to get locals doing. And I told locals, if you want help, this is what you will get help doing. Six things were recruitment, finances, dues collection and budgeting, advocacy, grievance representation, publications, regular publications, needs assessment, those six things. Mm-hmm. So if a local called and said, we need some staff help, it needs to be for one of those six things. And not immediately, because I didn't, it took me a while to get a little bit of a grasp on this, but after, within the first year, at the end of the first year thereabouts, I put a moratorium on any new charters, no new charter applications to cross my desk, because we didn't need any more 10-member locals located 500 miles from this office, made up of 10 people who hated their superintendent.
Right, right.
And instead, we started an organizing committee program aimed at getting organizing committees that could get those six things done as a condition for applying, one condition for applying for a charter. There were others. Later, we expanded that list of six to 12 and then to 13. The six are still there for survival, but if you want to be successful, there's an additional six. Mm-hmm. And an additional one got added on later, too. Those, but the six-point program became for the next 10 years the goal. The other thing we did, I did in... we had some very fortunate things occur. In 1982, the last really real Democrat got elected governor of Texas, and the last and it was the last time there was a Democratic sweep of the state offices. And we, for our part, we didn't guess right initially on the governor. We endorsed his opponent in the primaries. We made up for it, though, later on. And but we did guess right on a couple of key people. And found ourselves in a position disproportionate to our size to have some impact. And the biggest piece of luck was that that particular governor who'd run heavily on, Mark White was his name, okay, had run heavily on a campaign of improving education in Texas, couldn't get his program through the legislature. the Democrats were predominant, but in those days, Texas Democrats were not real Democrats in the main. And so he appointed a special committee headed by H. Ross Perot to put together, to investigate Texas public education and put together recommendations for top-to-bottom restructuring and reform of education in Texas. This became extremely important for us because most of the education community rallied around the idea of no outsider like Ross Perot should be dabbling into our business.
He's just some business billionaire.
Right.
No idea. Yeah.
We took a different tack and instead prepared a package of proposals to take to him. In 1983, I was at the convention in Los Angeles when I got a call from the office that said, can you come home early? H. Ross Perot wants to meet with you. So I, as it turned out, he put together this, he spent a lot of his own money. Mm-hmm. They said $1 million, which was a lot of money back then, 83. Hired consultants, hired staff, did some things in the way of lobbying that people should have learned from in our business, but don't seem to have. Anyway, we met with their consultants, we laid out our ideas, and when his report came out from his special committee, the teacher portion of it looked like we wrote it. It was, our hands were all over it. We did not go in and say, you need to just increase teacher salaries, for example. We said, there is a need for teacher pay increase, but more importantly, you need to reward people who are good at teaching, and you need to make it financially worthwhile to stay in teaching as opposed to moving into coaching or into administration or into some other profession. And so we recommended a career ladder, which they bought into. He came out with a controversial recommendation that all Texas teachers should take a test to keep their certificate. And then future teachers should pass a test to get a certificate. This was a real tough one. But we had the executive council in. We had a big debate. And in the end, I recommended, I said, I think we should support this. And we had a close vote, but I got a majority. And we were the only one of the education organizations, except for the Elementary Principals Organization, in the end, that supported the legislation that came out of this.
NEA and the two other independents.
They opposed it. So did the superintendent, so did the school boards, so did the secondary principals.
Is it because there was some sort of accountability going in here?
Various things. The school boards, there was something in there for everybody to hate. There was a statewide curriculum. School boards hated that. Remember my story earlier about the 11-cent tax rate?
Yeah.
And how you can't do that if you have to really offer, like, algebra and... So there was that. Superintendents hated, they hated the career ladder as much as people thought teachers would, because in writing the legislation, we tried to get the legislators to nail down specific things and to put an appeals process in there. Mm-hmm. So that you couldn't just say, okay, we like Mary better than Jane. You had to show why Mary was better than Jane, and based off of classroom observations that included two visits by the principal each year and two visits by someone from off that campus who was an expert in that field. There were some other requirements like extra education and minimal years of experience, like 3 years before you could begin moving up. And it couldn't be based on anything having to do with extracurricular activities, no coaching. Couldn't give all the coaches the career ladder money, for example. So the superintendents hated it. The coaches hated the legislation because it had in it a rule that students had to make a 70 in every class in order to participate in activities, extracurricular activities.
Passive play.
Yeah. And the secondary principals were disproportionately made up of coaches, ex-coaches, so they were... This was their big issue. Now, the elementary principal stayed with it, even though they hated a lot of these things too, but it had a class size cap of 22 pupils for pre-kindergarten through fourth grade. Not an average, but a cap.
Wow.
Indeed. And it established for the first time a requirement that school districts offer kindergarten to... 4-year-olds who were limited English proficient. Mm-hmm. If they had 20 of them, I believe, in their district, they had to have a program, and have a and they had to have a kindergarten program in every district. Didn't require parents to send their children,
but it was offered.
But it has to be offered. Still there. By the way, the RAND Corporation, in naming a few years ago Texas as tied with, I think, North Dakota or South Dakota as the best in the nation in teaching reading and math, cited those two factors as their idea of the cause: universal kindergarten access and the small class sizes in elementary grades. Before that law passed, it was an inverted pyramid. The biggest classes were in kindergarten, second biggest were in first grade. Mm-hmm. And so on up. The smallest classes were senior high school classes, which arguably is the worst way to do it, because if you're going to invest your money, the best place to sink it is kindergarten, pre-kindergarten. By the time they get to high school, if they've gotten the basics in kindergarten and pre-kindergarten, you don't have to worry about them. And if they haven't gotten the basics, you can forget about them. So this turned all of that on its head. Teachers, of course, were expected to hate it, and did, by and large, because of the requirement that they take a test to keep their certificate. If you look on my certificate, there's a sticker. See it?
Yeah.
TCAT, Texas Educator.
Yeah.
That means I passed the test. This was 1980. This legislation passed in 1984.
Okay.
Now,
what did the TFT hate about it? What did the TFT hate about this legislation? Was there anything that it seemed like you wanted?
Well, we didn't like the test either. Our members hated it, and I could make a very good case that it was a stupid thing to do. But here's the speech that I gave over and over again. I would go to a meeting and the teachers would say, "You can't tell me that just because I pass a test, that means I can teach." And I would say, "You're 100% right. And you can't tell me that if you cannot pass that test, that you can teach."
It's turning on its nail.
You have to have a knowledge of something. How can you teach what you don't know? Anyway, there was, in this bill, in addition to everything, there was a 40% increase in pay across the board. The salary schedule was cut from taking 40 years to get to the top down to 11. There was, at that time, the biggest tax bill in the history of the state to pay for, in the history of the nation, to pay for the biggest increase in education expenditures in the history of the nation. Oh, they eliminated the State Board of Education. Officially, we hated that. Unofficially, we were delighted. The State Board of Education was a disaster, and it was exactly what it is today. A bunch of nuts, mainly religious nuts, who've gotten elected because nobody paid any attention to that race, and who were using their position to strike evolution out of the biology textbooks, do things like go through and order that pictures of women carrying briefcases be taken out of textbooks because women's place was in the home. And now we were caught in a tough spot. We had to work with the bureaucracy over there. So officially we said we didn't like that, but privately we all thought it was great. And in fact, the governor appointed a State Board of Education that was the best we have ever had before or since. Wonderful people to work with. They hired the best commissioner of education we've had before or since. He was a wonderful man, took hard decisions, didn't mind standing up in front of a group of, whether it was friends like us or his worst enemies, he'd tell you what he thought and tell you if when he thought you were crazy and tell you when he thought you were right. Unfortunately, it was a political issue that was capable of exploitation, you know, democracy and all of that. So there was a provision in the law that said that after a period of time, the State Board of Education would become an elected body again. Okay. When that occurred, the quality of the board began to sink immediately, and today we're back right where we were, at the point where Ross Perot said of that board in those days, it reminded him of the Louisiana legislature in the 1930s. And I think we're back to that point.
Yeah.
So it now during that this period of time, TFT entered into this. By then, by 84, we'd grown to where we had about 6,000 members, actual members. It were tough times. Dallas, Harley Hiscox had tried to get his group to disaffiliate and had taken about half of them with him. So that of the 500 members they allegedly had, he cost us about 250. I had seen that coming. It was telegraphed. Trying to think.
TFT has now 6,000 members. You just got the education reform.
Oh, yeah.
Hiscock is doing his usual thing.
Yeah. Well, there's a Harley has his side of the story, too. AFT didn't behave in a totally honorable fashion with him. What happened is Chuck Richards had been director of organizing. He was friends with Harley and had made that deal about not paying per capita. And I was present when several times Harley said in Chuck Richards' presence, you know, we're not paying per capita. And Chuck didn't say, you have to do that, you must do that. I know they had that agreement. Mm-hmm. But then when Chuck got the axe and Phil moved in, Bob Porter hated Harley with a passion, and Phil had clearly a mandate to punish Harley, and did. And anyway, Harley retaliated by starting a separate organization, just what we need in this state, which I had seen coming. And this story being what it is, Harley it had been married to a woman named Maureen Peters, who had gone with him to Dallas and had been the secretary treasurer of the local. He was the president, that being because they were the first two members. But Harley had married a much younger woman, who's president now in Dallas, Amy Bolander. And not wanting to have his ex-wife around, he had fired her. So Maureen was unemployed, and when I became president, and we absolutely did not have the money to do it, but I hired her to be a TFD organizer and assigned her to Fort Worth, which was a waste of her talent. But Fort Worth is an eminently organizable place, but our local there was the pits. The real reason I hired her was when Harley left, I wanted somebody to be able to move into that situation who knew everybody and who could help us save the situation. So she did. And she held 250 members in. Harley started the United Teachers of Dallas. And we then had that rivalry for some period of time there. Eventually, things got to a situation where we were able to merge those two groups back together. Harley, Amy, and Maureen worked it all out among themselves and made it all work, which is something of an accomplishment. In fact, Amy and Maureen, I think, are very close friends. And in the long run, you know, we went through a very tough period of time, some years, but in the long run, we pulled things together in Dallas, and it's now our flagship local with 7,000 plus members. Meanwhile, during the aftermath of the House Bill 72 experience, we had an embarrassment of riches. We had more opportunities to start locals and organizing committees in the state than we could comply with. I think back, we threw out thousands of cards that people had returned to us saying they were interested in starting a local or joining. We could not get to them. Mm-hmm. Just didn't have the troops to do it. I don't know how many thousand members we lost or were unable to get in that fashion. We were the only organization speaking to the governor, lieutenant, and governor and speaker. They ostentatiously threw the other education organizations out of their office. I had a moment of personal satisfaction, a couple, I guess, during that period. During the time the legislation was being debated, I was in the Capitol, and the aide for the governor came running up to me and said, governor wants to see you in his office right now. So I said, okay, and I went over there, and when I went in, the governor, lieutenant governor, and all the senators were there, and they were giving me a standing ovation. That was at the point where we were standing by the legislation, and the other organizations were not. And then I got invited to speak to, well, I didn't realize what was happening. Again, they said, we want you to be on the floor of the House at this time. And I showed up, and it was a joint session of the House and Senate. And I was there along with Brad Duggan from the elementary principals as the only non-office holders to speak to the legislators. So at this point, we're an organization where the expression tail wagging the dog comes to mind, except that we weren't even big enough to be tail-sized. We had a very disproportionate influence on state policy. Right. We were able to leverage that into some gains. That we did pass the duty-free lunch law period law subsequent to House Bill 72 because of the position we were in, picture